All right, you can turn with me to Psalm 127 if you're not already there. We'll be tonight. Okay, well, last week we were in Psalm 126, and we talked about the fact that we are in between two deliverances. We have seen God deliver in the past, and we have a promise of his deliverance here in the future. But in between, we learned that we are called to pray and to work. Specifically, the work, if you look back at 126, the way that it was pictured at least, is this idea of sowing in tears, difficult labor. And it is in that that we are told that there will one day be those who return with rejoicing, those who sow in tears. But I was thinking, and as we head into Psalm 127, that could raise some questions in our mind. Where should we be laboring? How should we be laboring? Does that mean anybody who works hard will have these blessings? Does it mean that a good believer is a workaholic, putting in more hours than anybody else? And maybe we could ask this, how does a believer know that he's sowing in the proper way? I think that the next two Psalms, Psalm 127 here tonight and Psalm 128 next week, will help us to answer that type of question. So really what I want us to be asking tonight is, what should I be sowing in this planting time of my life as I wait for God's future harvest? I could say maybe I really do want to apply this principle of sowing and reaping, and I want to see God's glorious harvest and masterful deliverance. But how do I know what I'm supposed to be doing while I wait? What is the work that I should not be weary in doing? I think Psalm 127 will help us here. And today I'm calling this message, this lesson, sowing for security. Sowing for security. You know, that's really what we want. We want to reap in that joyful shouting that we heard last week. We want security. We want deliverance. We want hope. What seeds produce security? What are the seeds that we need to sow if we're going to produce security in our lives? And I'm going to kind of leave. I'm not going to have the curtain come back at the end. I'm just going to give you the answer, and I'm going to try to use the whole message to show it to us. Here's the answer. The answer is this, that enduring security is given, not gained. The big idea of Psalm 127 is enduring security is given by God's grace, not gained by our effort. If we're asking what seeds do we need to sow in order to reap joyful shouting, in one sense, we could say we're asking the wrong question, because what seeds produce security? We find the answer of this psalm is God's, not ours. God's seeds are ultimately the ones that are going to bear a harvest of security. And so in an ultimate sense, our sowing will never bring about the securing harvest that we seek. The answer for us is that God's gracious blessing is what's essential for true security and joyful reaping one day. So let's read this psalm, and then we'll explain what we see here. So Psalm 127, a song of ascents of Solomon. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors, for he gives to his beloved, even in his sleep. Behold, children are a gift from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. So, when it comes to having confidence in my ultimate future, where can I place my hope for future harvest? Well, the short answer is in God, right? But we can learn some important lessons about the source of security in three important areas of our lives from this psalm. And here they are: your vocation, we might say your job, your family, and even your salvation. We're going to look at each of those areas throughout the lesson tonight. And I want to begin with just working through some of the questions that often come up when we ask about our security or our significance from a big picture, lifelong perspective. The first question that maybe many people could ask is that security found in your labor itself? Does that joyful shouting come as a result of just your mere labor? So I want to talk about our vocations here tonight first, things that you do with your life. And I think, as I said at the outset, we will see that you need God's gracious blessing in your vocation. And there are going to be three lessons that we see specifically about what we do with our lives and the way that we are constantly pointed to the need of God for God's intervention if there's to be anything lasting and secure. So I have three real principles that I want to draw from verses 1 and 2 about your work or your vocation. The first one is this: the tentativeness of your vocational goals. The tentativeness of your vocational goals. Apart from his will, they are empty. That's really what verse 1 is all about. You see, there are two vocations pointed at here in verse 1. Look at them with me. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. Obviously, we have a builder and we have a watchman. We have a number of men in our congregation who kind of maybe fit into some of these categories. Maybe the first is the get it done builder. This is surely a planning intensive type of job. Building, we know, takes vision. You've got to have a picture of where you're going. It takes planning. You've got to have a process to get there. It takes cooperation to make sure you coordinate with all the appropriate people. And so if there was ever a job for a doer, it would probably be building. I think that this is a great picture of the doer. But we also have we could call it the keep it safe watchman. There are also probably a number of people in our congregation who would fall into this type of vocation or calling as well. This is all about analysis and concentration. Probably police officers and maybe even pastors would fall into this category. It's a very concentration intensive job. The goal is to recognize potential problems and then make sure that they're quickly addressed. And so it is a very concentration intense role. It's also a protecting role. The point of each of these is the same, though, whether you are the ultimate doer or the model concentrator, your effort is not the essential ingredient to your success. Let me say that again. No matter which category you're in, the point of this verse is that your effort is not the essential ingredient to success. Rather, it's God's initiative and his involvement. He has to be connected to your endeavor if it's to be a success that truly brings security. There's one descriptor that's used of each of these endeavors. Look down at verse 1, and you even see it again in verse 2. Each of these endeavors, apart from God's involvement, is described as vain. This is a concept that we would be very familiar with in another of Solomon's writings, Ecclesiastes. Though the word that's used here is different, the idea is the same. That without God's connection to our labor, it's empty. And this really is the first lesson that we're supposed to learn about our calling, our vocation, our work. It's the tentativeness of your vocational goals, that apart from God's will, they're empty. Now, how could we apply this today for those of us who are going about our jobs day in and day out? Well, our world puts a real high priority on success and productivity. Told some of you before that I really like to read books about that. And there's really a place for that. But we should not believe that expended energy or progress is inherently successful. Let's take this even a step further. Our world tends to push us to find our identity in our jobs or our vocations. We are what we do. But if that's the case, then there is at least the possibility raised here that some of these most important tasks may prove ultimately unsuccessful. How would that impact your identity if the very thing that you were putting all of your life into was left unfulfilled? I think all of this points to something even more foundational, and more enduring for true security. We cannot allow our identity to be wrapped up in what we do. There is no guarantee that you or I will find earthly success in your endeavors. Let me just give you a couple examples of how that could be assumed throughout Israel's history. Let's take that builder first. What if he builds his house seeking to find that long-term stability and security for his family in it? And then, as we have talked about in recent weeks, there were those numerous times in which Jerusalem or all of Israel was invaded by some outside force. Do you think that in the midst of a war, every house protected its inhabitants? The answer is clearly no. So we can see why that would not be a good place for our hope and security. What about the watchman? Let's go back to that same situation. If an opposing army attacked, in some circumstances, it really doesn't matter whether you see them coming or not, if they have an overpowering force. In a case like this, let's just say the watchman is really known for being so good at spotting suspicious activity. But in this case, whether he fulfills his job perfectly or not really doesn't matter. Security is compromised because of the overwhelming force. My point is that even in great effort and labor, there is a tentativeness to our goals. So let me bring it to our day. No matter what you do in life, take no ultimate security in the success of your endeavor. Think about it. I'm just going to throw out a few of the ideas I've already brought up. As a pastor, we know that Christ is going to build his church, but that offers no promise regarding particular local churches. Many pastors have faithfully exercised their ministry in a place that, when all is said and done, there's really not much earthly to show for it. People have rejected the message. Jeremiah was a lot like that as an Old Testament prophet. Think about this. As a building or a contractor, though you do good, honest work, who can promise that there won't be a 2008 to ruin you? Or who can foresee all the contingencies to protect yourself and your business from harm? Maybe as a police officer, you faithfully do your duty, but who is in control of people's perception of you? You could do what you're supposed to do, and yet in the eyes of those around you, you could be looked down upon. I'm not going to go through every vocation, but my point is that you can work and your vocational goals could come to nothing. And that's why we all need to learn the tentativeness of our vocational goals, that apart from God's will, they are empty. So hopefully we see that, but there's another lesson here in verse 2 that I think is really important in relation to the way that we work in our vocations. Here it is. In verse 2, we see the weakness of your vocational efforts. Apart from his gift, they're futile. I'll say that again. The weakness of your vocational efforts here in verse 2. Apart from his gift, they're futile. Read verse 2, the first part of it with me. It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors. So the weakness of your vocational efforts, apart from God's gift, they're futile. The first part of this says that they're futile no matter how long you work. Do you see that idea in the text? It says it's vain for you to rise up early and to retire late. You could rise up early and retire late and your efforts could be vain. It's not just in how long you work that might not matter. It's also no matter how hard you work, it may not matter. Look at that in the text. It says it's vain for you to eat the bread of painful labors. You could eat the bread of painful labors. Your sustaining strength could be hard work, and all your efforts could be in vain. I was thinking about maybe a way to illustrate this in our modern world. And my mind went to the richest man in the world, Elon Musk. He's recently retaken that, honor. I don't know if that's the right word or not, but think about if you know anything about Elon Musk's schedule and his intensity, we can actually, I think, see this illustrated well. He stays up, he says his schedule, he stays up till around 1 each night, and then gets up usually around 7, looking for 6 and a half hours of sleep. And then most of those waking hours are consumed with work. Sounds a lot like this text, getting up early and staying up late. Then he's said that he often skips his meals, at least during the day, because he seems to get his sustenance from work as much as, or even more than, food. Sounds a lot like eating the bread of painful labors. Now, after talking about Elon Musk, you may say, well, wait a second. This actually seems to go against what this text is saying, because he seems to be a bad example, because he's actually very successful and secure. And I would say, yes, but only in a sense. Because remember, this is talking about enduring security. This is something more stable, lasting. You know, the individual who built his house, or that watchman who's never had an enemy break through on his watch, could also, in one sense, claim success. But there could be situations, like we talked about just a moment ago, that could overthrow that stability and that security. Now, I'm not trying to make predictions about Elon Musk, that he's going to tank or anything like that. But I will say this. Throughout history, how many times have we seen great men lose their security and success almost overnight? My point is that, as this text says, no matter how long you work, no matter how hard you work, your vocational efforts are weak and they could be in vain. And why is that? Well, both of these are also pointing back, actually pointing forward at the very end of the verse, to this fact. The essential element, again, is not your work, but God's involvement. Now, I'm going to say this throughout. Don't think that I'm trying to diminish a good work ethic or working hard. Hopefully, I'm going to be able to address that more next week, but I'm not doing that. But here's the question that we must ask. Are we putting our hopes in vocational efforts? And just to be clear, I don't just mean the things that we're salaried for. This could really be anything that you're responsible to do in your life, any of the big picture goals that you are striving for. So I am for hard work. I'm not saying hard work is unimportant. I'm just saying that hard work is not supreme. If you could guarantee that your hard work would make you successful, that would be one thing, but you can't. And that's the point. There is a need for God's special blessing, or as we'll see at the end of verse 2, his gift. And we find it right there. So let's look at this third principle that we find about our work or our vocation. And here it is. It's the surprise of your vocational rest. The surprise of your vocational rest. Apart from your work, God is working. The final principle that we see is that, look at the end of verse 2. Why is all this true? Because God gives to his beloved, even in his sleep. The surprise of your vocational rest, that apart from your work, God is working. Even when you are doing nothing, God may be doing everything. Let's just think about all the various ways that we could notice how God works in powerful ways, even when we do nothing. We've probably all heard stories of someone's big break coming because of some random connection or chance happening. Often happens in the business world or the world out there. But even in routine life, we see that there's something outside of a person's vision and effort that make the difference. Sometimes it's, as people would say, just being in the right place at the right time. There's something outside the person that changes things. Biblically, we know that it's not merely something, it's someone. It's God who gives to his beloved even in sleep. God is at work in the life of those whom he loves. He gives to them and it's totally independent of their own effort. Again, this is not to tell us to go quit our jobs, let go and let God. It's quite the opposite. It doesn't negate our duty to sow, but it puts it in its proper perspective. God is at work even when we are resting. This is the surprise of your vocational rest, that even when you are doing nothing, God may be doing everything. Sometimes it's in your ceasing that the real increasing happens. It even points to the idea of seeds growing while the farmer sleeps. So if you ask this, if your security is in your labor, you will be confronted with the necessity of God's gracious blessing in your vocation. And we just saw three lessons to drive this idea home. First, the tentativeness of your vocational goals, that apart from his will, they're actually empty. We saw the weakness of your vocational efforts, that apart from his gift, they're futile. And then we saw the surprise of your vocational rest, that sometimes, apart from your work, God is working. The culminating moment of these first couple verses is that after you have toiled and toiled, God may be doing his most securing work in the midst of your sleep. For instance, and this is actually where he goes next, even the miracle of conception seems to happen while you're sleeping. And this is actually the place he goes. So now I want to transition to family life. Let's talk about another place that it's so easy to find security and look to security. Does security come from family planning? And I think what we're going to find is that the family is even another way that we see the necessity for God's gracious blessing. And again, we'll find it in three ways, three lessons that we learn from looking at the need for God's gracious blessing in our families. First, I want to point out in verse 3, the generous nature of your family's fruitfulness. Look at verse 3. Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. I want to say that again. The generous nature of your family's fruitfulness. The point here seems to be that even conception is a work of God. In that culture, where children were desired and of great importance for the future stability and security of a family, it would have been very easy to think that, hey, we know the equation of conception, so we can get our intended result pretty simply. And I want to be careful here, but we see that very clearly was the mentality when we see kings, Solomon in particular, multiplying wives, right? We see this all throughout the ancient Near East. But one of the threads woven throughout the Bible is the frustrating inability of some very prominent characters to have children. Old Testament, we think of people like Abraham and Sarah. New Testament, Zechariah, Elizabeth. And this seems to be an example of the principle that we learned in the first section, that we can labor and put forth effort to a certain end, but only God brings about the appropriate result. Very simply, I think the application is that conception and childbearing is God's gracious work. We can plan and pursue, but only God can provide. Now, I want to take a really quick side note at this point, because I think this verse is really important, and I'll just say this, really needed in our world at large. And there are a few things that I want to point out. We see here clearly that conception is God's business. Conception is God's gift. Every child is a gift from God. Our culture gets this wrong in a number of ways. And I think it's worth pointing those out. First of all, our belief, at least in the Western world, that we are ultimately in charge of conception. We believe we can choose everything about childbearing. If we want to have children, when we want to have children, how we want to have children. But God says that children ultimately are his gift. Obviously, I'm not removing the clear and obvious human element in conception, but we must recognize, as many of God's saints throughout the ages have, that conception is ultimately in the hands of God. Secondly, our belief in our culture that children are a curse rather than a blessing. I think that this verse goes right at that false idea. I hope that I'm not speaking to anyone today who would hold this, but there may be some that think this way. Let me just say very clearly that the biblical teaching is totally contrary to the idea that children are to be avoided at all costs. No, children are a blessing, a gift from God. We must seek to confront the contrary teachings of our world on these issues. I think it's important to point both of these out because the Bible confronts these false assumptions. So let's look at the next thing that we learn about our family life. Look at this. Verse 4 talks about the hopeful nature of your family's future. The hopeful nature of your family's future. Look at verse 4. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. The hopeful nature of your family's future is clearly addressed here. That your security is given, maybe in a surprising way, your security is given by God through the next generation. The children of a man's youth bring confidence just like arrows to a warrior. Hope for the family's future is derived from the blessed gift of God to families. Children, the next generation is one of the means by which God provides for the security of the family. This gift from God helps the man to confidently confront the uncertain future of his life. Just as a warrior who has been given sufficient arrows can confidently confront the uncertain future of war. You see, children are meant to provide hope for the future, hope for our family, and could I even say it like this, hope for our future of our culture and our nation and our world. Isn't it interesting then that children are so often demeaned and treated as a problem? We sure get things confused in our sinful world, don't we? But let me just be really clear about what we've seen so far. Instead of a burden, children are a blessing. Instead of being chastened for having children, we should be congratulated. Children bring courage for the future, not shame in the present. These are lessons that we need to reteach to our world. But I've got to keep going on. There's one more lesson that I think is really important at the end in verse 5 about family. And here it is, the surprising nature of your family's triumph. I think verse 5 speaks about the surprising nature of your family's triumph. You know, we're wondering how do we reap in the context of a family? Well, what may be surprising, what is explained as the triumph here in the family. Look at verse 5. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. Your victory, in a sense, is, I this may not be the best word, but vicarious. I can't think of a different, better word. So often in our families, we put so much pressure that I'm going to be the one that changes everything. But in this case, at least, it's pointing to this, that the victory of your family could be coming through your descendants. In the midst of our incessant temptation, especially in the Western world, to be so focused on ourselves and to think that everything's about me, all hope rests on my vision and my efforts, we're told that hope within our family actually comes from maybe the least expected place, our children. This point requires a little extra explanation, though. I want to look at verse 5 with you a couple things, because first of all, in one sense, the illustration from verse 4 is just continued on, because notice he mentions a quiver there in verse 5. A quiver, we know, is the ancient container for arrows. Many of us are familiar with those. And so it seems that in one way, the illustration is continuing, because blessing is pronounced on those who have their quiver full of children. But in another sense, we're left questioning what the actual purpose of the illustration is, because the passage closes with these words. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. So I want two important points to help clarify the meaning of what this is saying. First of all, who is not ashamed? Who are the people who are not ashamed? Well, if you're looking at the NAS, you see the word they. If you have the ESV, you see the word he, though in a footnote, you would have the word they. This highlights the importance of answering this question. Is this the father who won't be ashamed, or is this the children who are not ashamed? Well, I believe the clear answer is the children. I'm not going to take time to explain why that is, but I do think that it's clear. It's saying that the children will not be ashamed. Second, why will they not be ashamed? Or we could ask this another way. What does it mean to speak with enemies in the gate? Again, there are two primary options here. First, you could be carrying over the warfare analogy with arrows and understand that this is a confrontation at the gate, and it's a military one. If that's the case, then it's saying that the descendants will be a primary means by which the father is protected from physical harm of enemies. The second idea is that we don't carry the warfare analogy, and we understand this to mean the primary business that takes place in the gates. That would be legal matters. If this is the case, then it's saying that the father's security will be provided for through offspring who are going to stand up for him when he cannot stand up for himself. Now, I don't know that we can necessarily rule out either of these, but I definitely lean toward the second. If you were with us in our Ruth series, you remember that Boaz did all his legal arrangements at the city gate. This was the place for the court, so to speak, or business matters. And I do believe that we're thinking of a similar situation here. So the idea is that it's actually through these children that God is going to be providing for the father when he cannot even provide for himself anymore. And so the surprising nature of your family's triumph is that it actually does not come from you, but somebody else. And at least in this case, the triumph of your family comes from God's children who he's gifted to you. It really is a surprising and a beautiful message. But all through this section, we have emphasized how finite we truly are. The passage closes with the children, not the father, doing the confrontation in the gates. And I think at least the assumption is that he is either unable to do so or is no longer present to do so. I think it's clearly pointing to the limitations or the finitude of the self. We are frail. We are weak. It is not just our efforts that will prove to be insufficient. It is even our very person. We have limitations. This seems to be the thought that we are confronted with at the end of our passage. Yet in the midst of our personal limitation, God shows that he already has provided through his gift of children. It's like, even though you will be tested, God is already preparing for your triumph. Now, I think I've spent a lot of time emphasizing some of the physical application of this throughout, with physical children and God's blessing on the family. But I really do think that there's some spiritual application here as well. So even for those of you who don't have families of your own, whether single or widowed or not having children, I think that there is some great application here. Because in the same way that all these realities are very clear physically, we can see some really clear spiritual parallels. For instance, parallel between conception and conversion spiritually, or the next generation of children and the next generation of believers. Maybe the future triumph through offspring physically in our families, and the future triumph through the young believers. What I'm saying here is that you have application in the various spheres of your spiritual experience as well. In the same way, let's take the conception idea that a married couple can't force conception. So you can't force conversion, believer. Though you are called by your master to go into all the world and preach the gospel to all nations, making disciples, you can do everything that you're supposed to do. But ultimately, it is when your efforts are complete that God's miracle can happen. Think about your confidence for the future, just like that warrior who has arrows or that father who has children. Instead of thinking that all hope rests on you, recognize that the more people you disciple, the more confidently you can go into future battles. Or think about this, what we saw at the very end there, this idea that you're going to pass off the scene one day. You're going to be unable to go forward. And those whom you've discipled will come to your aid and make the difference for the cause that you've always desired. So I think that there is application here for all of us. So very quickly, let me review what we've said here before I get on to the way I want to close. If we ask this question, we already found we couldn't find security in just our labor and our work and our vocation. So can we find security in our family planning? The answer is no. We can't force things to happen in our family any more than our vocation. Rather, our family is another sphere in which we're utterly dependent upon God's initiative and involvement for our blessing. And we saw that his involvement in our family is classified as a gift when he blesses us with children. And so we saw that no matter what we do, God is the author of life. He's the creator and he's the giver of life to our families. Next, we learned how the present blessing of children gives hope for the future. And then finally, we saw that this psalm painted a surprising picture that though we think that everything rests on us, very often your children may be the very means of your own deliverance or continuance. So we've learned a lot from this psalm already, but I want to hasten to make one more crucial point from this psalm. I think that after going through the whole psalm, we might actually get to the root question that has really been at the bottom of the other two. And here it is. Is security in yourself? We've already seen that it's not in your vocation. It's not in your own family planning. Throughout, this psalm has seemed to confront our reliance upon ourselves to take care of our own needs and our own issues. So let's just get the big question out in the open. Is your security in yourself? And this really takes us to the level of ultimate big questions, even questions of salvation and security. And I think that we find application here, even in this psalm. You see, you need God's gracious blessing in your salvation too, not just your vocation, not just your family, but even in your ultimate hopes. You may even wonder where I get that from this passage, especially since I've already gone through all the verses. But I think that we're actually directed to this in something that I skipped over, the subtitle. You may have noticed that this psalm, when I read it, actually has some extra information in the title. And after the last couple of weeks, we spent so much time talking about the context this the psalms could have been written in. Maybe it was surprising that we haven't talked about that yet today. Obviously, we're not told an exact context, but we are told that there is a link to Solomon. I want us to finish by thinking about the potential significance of this fact to our understanding of the salvation significance to this psalm. I think this is going to show us two lessons about our need for God's gracious blessing for salvation. So reflect with me now as we think about how Solomon, as the author of this psalm, helps us to understand at even another level. So if we ask, is your security in yourself? I think we're going to get this answer. I want to point out very clearly, the answer is no. And the first idea here is the sad failure of mere human effort. The sad failure of mere human effort for eternal value. Unfortunately, Solomon is the quintessential example of this, because the failure of mere human effort is clear throughout this psalm. Let me just give you an example. A builder can't ensure security for his home. A watchman can't ensure security from his focus. A parent can't ensure children from his planning or initiative. The insufficiency of mere human effort for temporal security is clearly emphasized. But what about eternal security? Though I don't think that that question is explicitly addressed by this psalm, I think when we take a big picture view of Solomon, I think we're led on a very good and helpful journey. So I quickly want to take you along that path. There are a number of elements of this psalm that seem to take on special significance when we consider that Solomon was the author. First, building the house. I'm not going to do this, but if you want to skim through the first 9 chapters of 1 Kings, you will see how often this idea is used. And I'll tell you, it's a lot. Sometimes it refers to Solomon building his house, but most of the time, it refers to him building God's house in Jerusalem, the temple. What about guarding the city? As the king, this would have been core to Solomon's calling. He was, in a sense, the preeminent watchman of the city. He was to be prepared to act in defense of the city and the nation. But in his case, the city would be Jerusalem. What about the word vain? We mentioned this earlier, but though it's a different word, this idea of vanity is almost a calling card for Solomon. He knew all about it. What about giving to his beloved, even in sleep? Well, this one's interesting for 2 reasons. First of all, the Hebrew word for beloved is very similar to the name that God gives to Solomon in 2 Samuel 12, verse 22, Jedidiah. Second, the idea of God giving to his beloved, even in sleep, seems also very appropriate to Solomon's experience. Do you remember that early in Solomon's reign, it was actually in a dream that God allowed him to ask for anything, and Solomon asked for wisdom. God gave to his beloved even in sleep. And finally, the idea of children is quite appropriate to Solomon. I haven't mentioned it yet to this point, but the word children in those final verses is actually the word sons. Now, I think it's appropriate to broaden the application to all children, but when we consider Solomon, the idea of sons is especially important. in light of God's covenant with David. Do you remember God made a great promise to David about a dynasty that would reign through successive generations of sons? So it's at least interesting to note that though Solomon had so many wives and so many sons, only one of those sons actually became king, Rehoboam. And if you know anything about Rehoboam's reign, you know that that was not a good story. So all this to say, I think recognizing Solomon as the author does highlight a number of significant ideas. But now let me really bring this point to a head. If you look at the results of Solomon's human labor in each of these areas that we've discussed, in a sense, they could be considered a failure. Think with me. First of all, the house. The house that he built for the Lord would surely be glorious. But throughout its history, it would be misused by kings and the people, and then ultimately destroyed in the exile. Think about the city. Yes, during Solomon's time, Jerusalem was protected from outside invaders, but ultimately it was overrun by the enemy within him as he introduced false worship. Then, as many of his descendants followed his lead in this area, the whole city would one day be taken and laid waste by Nebuchadnezzar. That's what came of Solomon's watch. And then his son. As I alluded to a moment ago, Solomon had many sons, but only one of them became king, and that was Rehoboam. When Rehoboam becomes king, instead of securing his father's legacy, he rejects it. Remember, he rejected the advice of all the counselors of his fathers for the advice of those who are closer to him. Again, another failure. It's like in every point, Solomon, though seemingly so successful, at least for a time, his legacy and his effort are brought low. And so that's why I think we can very clearly see the sad failure of mere human effort for eternal value. But I need to hasten to say this. There's one more important lesson in relation to salvation and security, because there's another side to this coin, and it's surely a better one. The other idea is this, the glorious triumph of God's plan for eternal value. Though Solomon's efforts, in a sense, came to nothing, God's purpose was not thwarted. Let me go back through each of these and show how, even from a human perspective, each of those was a failure. God turned failure into glory. Let's take the house. Yes, the Solomonic temple would be destroyed, but the New Testament makes very clear that that was never the ultimate purpose. God continues to move forward his plan with another temple today, the temple that Peter refers to as the one made up by you and me, living stones in the spiritual temple of God. And then ultimately, the dwelling place of God will be all of the new heavens and the new earth as the holy city, New Jerusalem, comes down from heaven from God so that he might perfectly dwell with his people. So that takes me to the idea of keeping the city. Yes, Jerusalem was taken by Nebuchadnezzar, the city that Solomon was called to protect. A number of others also took it throughout the ages. But we know this has not stopped God's plan. Remember what the author to the Hebrews tells them in chapter 12? They've now come to the heavenly Jerusalem. He said that this is the kingdom that cannot be shaken. And as I alluded to, we are awaiting a day when it will come down out of heaven. What, though, or I guess I should say who, will bring all this about? And that brings me to the final consideration, the son. Rehoboam was definitely a failure, but he was not the ultimate seed of the woman promised to Eve. He was not the ultimate descendant of Abraham who would bring blessing to the world. He was not the lion from the tribe of Judah that would destroy all his enemies. And he was not the greater son of David who would be the priest king to bring people to God. No, Rehoboam was not the son that Solomon needed. Jesus was, and Jesus came, and he will come again too. And so therefore, Jesus, the descendant of Solomon, gives Solomon hope. So just one more thing I want to point out in line with this. After section one, we talked about the fact that after working and working, God might do the most securing work even while you sleep. If I could broaden this out just a bit, that is exactly what God was doing while Solomon was sleeping, the sleep of death. Think about it. When Solomon was doing nothing, he couldn't do anything. He was dead. God sent the one greater than Solomon into the world to bring eternal security to Solomon and to all who would put their faith in him. Now, I realize that was a lot, but I hope those two main points are clear. This psalm wants to hammer home the sad failure of mere human effort for eternal value, but the glorious triumph of God's plan for eternal value. And what we did is we looked at our vocation, our family, and even ourselves, and we saw that these are not places that we can find this ultimate security. And all that led us to a theme that enduring security is given, not gained. It's something that comes by God's grace and not by our effort. God's gracious blessing is essential for true security. And so with that principle in mind, we've been equipped to apply each of these in every sphere of our lives. We saw that in our vocation, we need to be learning the tentativeness of our vocational goals. Apart from his will, they're empty. We need to learn the weakness of our vocational efforts. Apart from his gift, they're futile. And then we need to learn the lesson of the surprise of vocational rest, that sometimes and often, apart from our work, God is working. In relation to our family, we learned the generous nature of our family's fruitfulness. It's not as a result of our efforts. Actually, our work is secondary to God's gift. We learned the hopeful nature of our family's future. Security is actually given, and at least in this context, by the coming generation. And then finally, the surprising nature of our family's triumph. We think that our families rise and fall on us, but really, victory often comes through descendants. So finally, and most importantly, in relation to ourselves, the source of all of our false securities, we learned two essential lessons: the sad failure of mere human effort for eternal value, but the glorious triumph of God's plan for eternal value. Now, this has been, I have really loved this psalm, but I also realize it was a lot. There was a lot that I wanted to say tonight, but where do we go from here? I want to finish by just reminding us of the theme. Enduring security, brothers and sisters, is given by God's grace, not gained by our efforts. God's gracious blessing is essential for true security. So therefore, we need to live our lives, not looking to ourselves, our efforts, our foresight, our strength, but we looked to our God and Savior. He is the one that gives significance even to our sleep. Our times are in our hands. Our tasks are in his hands. To keep with the alliteration, even our tots, our children, are in his hands. We learn from Psalm 127, we learn the idea of dependence. As Paul says, we are not sufficient of ourselves. Our sufficiency is of God. And so let's sow for security by seeking God's involvement in our every endeavor for his eternal glory and that great harvest that he graciously gives to his people. Let's pray. Lord, I know I need this. Lord, it is so easy for us to think that life becomes all about us. And we by no means want to relinquish our responsibilities in this life. And yet, you know, very often it's easy for us to think that we are our own hope. So easy for us to think that we can plan and control things so perfectly. Or we can't do that in our jobs. We can't do that in our family. And we surely can't do that in our salvation. And so would you teach us the lesson of dependence? No matter what the sphere of life is, may we see that unless you're with us in it, it's vain. But then, Lord, may we rejoice in light of eternity that you are doing great things in and through us for your glory, because you are good. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.